Hi, listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Boundless and Bare podcast. My name is Melissa Ridge. I will be your host. I'm here with another guest, Phil Lynch. Phil is a poet based in Dublin. He has a collection of poetry called In a Changing Light, and I can't wait to hear the story of how he got into spoken word. Phil, how are you doing today?
I'm great. And you?
I am good. I am delighted to have you on this podcast. I've been dying to get you on, and I'm delighted you're here with us now.
I'm equally delighted, or more delighted, because, it came as a nice surprise to be invited, and gives me hope that, old ageism isn't kicking in.
Absolutely not. But that is a big issue with the spoken word scene. I think that, I feel like spoken word is for everybody and anybody, but yet there seems to be an influx of young people less so than people of an older age.
Yeah, well, I think that's understandable as well, and I'm probably one of the exceptions maybe to the rule, but I can't complain, because I was a teenager myself once, and when I first got involved in this kind of stuff. So it's great, and in fact this year has been particularly good, because I got invited to do a slot at the All-Ireland Slam final as well, which was a nice little surprise, and was delighted to do it. So here I am.
And do you think, why do you think that not more older poets are taking part in spoken word events?
Well, there's actually a fair few when you think about it, but, maybe not as well known sometimes, or don't do as much as some other people, or as much as I do sometimes as well. It is quite all-embracing, actually, and that's one of the things I found. I mean, I really got back into taking all this fairly seriously about 10 years ago, and I have to say the whole community that I've encountered has been very welcoming and very inclusive. There are, as we know, lots of little wars that break out in the poetry and spoken word world every so often, but I try to avoid those as best as possible.
Probably for the best. For the last few years, you've been a regular on the performance circuit. Have you been performing regularly for the last 10 years?
Yeah, pretty much so. Yeah, I was living abroad in Belgium and came back just 10 years ago, actually, towards the end of 2009. And it was funny, because I used to run events myself years ago, and was very involved as a teenager, early 20s, in the poetry and whatever scene was going on. And I never left it quite, but it kind of took a back seat. When I was coming back, I decided I wanted to do something more with it and make more time for it. So I had the thought in my head, because when I was back and forth between times, I couldn't find very much happening, and thought, I've got to come back and I'll start up something again. And then, of course, the first week or so I was back, my daughter plays music, and she was playing with a band in Bewley's down in Grafton Street, and she said to me at the end of the night, we usually go down to the Inter for a couple of pints afterwards, and there's a guy who runs a night down there. It's a mixture of poetry and music. You might be interested in it. And so down we went, and it was the Glower Sessions and Stephen James Smith. And my daughter introduced me to Stephen, and he came down in typical fashion. You'll do a poem then, will you? So that was it. That started literally
Where you met Stephen James Smith for the first
time. Yeah, exactly. So I did a poem that night, and he asked me back a few weeks later to do a slot, kind of. And the funny thing is, I used to do sort of party pieces and things occasionally at sort of late night gatherings, and there'd be all other people's poems, the poems that I just liked or whatever. And somebody then cottoned on to the fact that I wrote a bit myself. I said, why don't you do some of your own? I said, I actually don't know any of them off by heart to do, so I don't carry them around in my pocket. So I had begun to actually try to memorise a few, and it all coincided with what I discovered to be the burgeoning sort of spoken word scene in Dublin and Ireland. Yeah.
And you mentioned before that you resist the categorisation of spoken word poet or poet. How would you define yourself as a writer?
I think there's a bit of a misnomer about, some people like to categorise them as well and like to stay within boxes, but I don't see any reason for that. And I think, there's certainly lots of room for crossover, and we were talking earlier about the age profile maybe of people in spoken word, and that might be one of the things that put some people off, that they think it's a young people game or whatever, or that the nature of what's done in spoken word, and there's to me, there's good poetry and bad poetry, and I'm not saying which category you're in. But, but, you know, and I think that's what counts at the end of the day. Now, you know, there's the slam poetry, which I think people also confuse with spoken word.
Yeah, they often think that when you're talking about spoken word, yeah. they automatically think it's the competition element of it.
Or out-and-out performance poetry, which is a kind of another category as well, you know. But for me, anything, even if it's read aloud, is spoken word.
You know,
whether you're reading from a book or not, you know. And then you veer into the more extreme, if you like, want to say, forms of spoken word, which lead into performance poetry, slam poetry, whatever. And yeah, some of it can be and is more immediate and more emotional and more spontaneous and all of that, and maybe never sees a page or whatever. But a lot of it, I think most serious spoken word artists,
it should be able to be read on the page and enjoyed when it's performed.
Yeah, for the most part, And I think pretty much people who perform, whether they admit it or not, do so with some trepidation and, you know, prepare.
And that's
the secret of it, like, you know, as well. So it gives the lie to the fact that there is this notion or concept that it's all sort of ranting and raving and stuff like that, you know.
So you're originally from Westmeath. What brought you to Dublin?
The road, the bus. You know, I grew up there and didn't stay long actually there because my mother was a teacher and went off to work in a school. She was one of these people that retrained to go back into work. And so she went to a different school. So was taken out of the local area even early on. Went to secondary school then in Mullingar, a boarding school, which was a very rough regime. Could talk a lot about that, but however.
Is that where you started writing?
Yeah, exactly. It was very strict and tough. We had no contact with the outside world and weren't allowed to have things like newspapers because they were banned, because only day pupils could bring them in, and day pupils were forbidden to bring anything in to order. So therefore you're found with a paper. It was a punishable offence. You know,
contraband, Jesus.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So that was the kind of nature, just to give you a flavour. So yeah, I was there, I left in 1968, say it low, so it was 60s, it was the age of student sort of revolutions and rebellions and all the rest of it. So a couple of started a few societies, you know, against the kind of, not with the blessings of the powers that be. One was a photographic society I was involved with, it was an art society. And
you didn't have your Mullingar version of the Dead Poets Society, no?
No, we had various societies, all right, but didn't centre around poetry. More about that, you know. One of the things they started was in a student kind of mag, you know, so they asked me to contribute something, or where everybody was welcome to contribute or whatever. So I wrote what I assumed to be song lyrics, being the 60s and all that. And they published it under Poetry Corner or something like that. And then they asked me to write something for the next one. So that's how that started. And that was literally, and the funny thing about it is, I've talked about this before, I wasn't really into the poetry and I wasn't really getting the poetry we were studying, you know. And suddenly when I started to write and this and think about myself and where it was coming from and what it meant, it was like I described it before as some sort of a Pentecostal sort of moment that I suddenly began to, the penny dropped on the stuff we were learning, you know. And I suppose it was probably in the year I did my Leaving Cert and that all this happened, and my English teacher, I think, never figured out how I did so well in the Leaving Cert, because up to that I hadn't been performing well as far as he was concerned.
I had the same issue as well. I was told by my English teacher I would never pass English, but here we are.
There you go.
So I wanted to ask you about the process of writing your first collection, In a Changing Light. When did you have the idea, okay, this is happening, I'm going to create a manuscript and I'm going to get published?
I always had the ambition to do it, but never got around to it. It had been published back in the day as a teenager and stuff, interestingly enough, by the Capuchin magazine at the time. It was called Eirig, and the editor of that was big into what was going on at the time in the young poetry scene. So it started off. So I suppose from ever since then, and having stuff in other magazines and so on. But yeah, it was, I did, in the pre-internet days, and especially living abroad, you had to get everything typed up, photocopied, find out the golden pages to see where you might send it to and all of this kind of stuff, you know. So it wasn't that accessible, and I just didn't have the time. I kind of had a long, long sabbatical from the whole thing, except keeping at it, but not very openly. So I come back, as I said, about 10 years ago. I fell into this whole mushrooming of poetry and spoken word that was going on. And I began to dust down a lot of the old stuff I had and rewrite most of it, actually.
Yeah, some people, when they talk about collections, they think about it's a way of putting their old poems to bed, like they've done their work and now this is where they lay to rest. Or is exactly. that the situation with your
It was very much collection? What I thought, yeah. And, you know, there are some old pieces in it, but some of them had been featured by in radio programs and that back in the day. So I thought I shouldn't leave them out. Raised some eyebrows with some people, and I'd say, well, I wrote this one back in 1970 or whatever, you know. But, I couldn't wait to get them into a collection and get it off my back. And that's quite literally. But I did so with the sort of notion that as soon as these are put to bed, as you described it, it's going to flow. You know, I won't be able to stop the flow. I'll have another collection out next year. You know, it hasn't happened.
It'll come.
It's coming, and I am working towards getting another collection together. But yeah.
So the first poem you have for us is titled "In a Changing Light."
That's right.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the poem before we hear it?
Yeah, well, again, I only wrote it actually about 5 years ago, maybe, or thereabouts, 5, 6 years ago, maybe. And but it was always in my head that I wanted to write this down in some way or other, because it's one of my earliest and still one of my most exciting kind of memories is the arrival of electricity to what was then my childhood home. And it's also one of the first poems, I think, that I reference my parents in, even if not by name, but both of them are mentioned. And it's been good to me because, it got me a runner-up prize in the IE8's poetry competition about 5 years ago. It got picked up people who were making a documentary for RTE about the rural electrification scheme. So they interviewed me and I read it, and it was on the documentary. There was an accompanying book that it was included in as well. So all told, it's been... And it was a funny thing because I was listening to the radio one morning and the Saturday morning business programme was on, and I was sitting there and the next thing I heard these words, I said, Jesus, that sounds familiar. And then I realised they are my words. And if somebody quote... Somebody had been a conference during the week on energy, on the future of energy or whatever like that, and supply and all that. And somebody apparently quoted the last couple of lines of this poem.
That's
I think, and they were being re-quoted then to somebody who was being interviewed, you know. So it's one of those. And the funny thing is as well, when I perform it sort of at live sessions, I'm always a bit wary because the age level tends to be fairly young, relatively speaking, and yet it's one of the ones that people come up to me afterwards and say, "I really like that," and and I remember my parents talking about that or whatever, or my grandparents maybe even, you know. So it resonates still with people. So,
all right, let's give it a listen.
Changing light. It was nearly dark when he came in from the fields, tired from the toils of the day, ready to complain about the tilly lamp still unlit. Would he have to light it himself, he asked, of no one in particular. In the shadow of an empty space beneath the stairs, I stood primed. The men with the metal boots, their belts heavy as a gunslinger's, had spent what seemed like years digging holes to plant the creosote forest that stretched across the countryside, with giant spools of wire unfurled along roads and lanes and fields. I marvelled at how they scaled the heights of those black poles and worked at right angles to the ground without falling. Stuntmen all. In the countdown to dusk I waited, finger on the switch as if to take its pulse, or like some general in the Kremlin with his thumb on the red button, waiting for the order to push. The predetermined signal came from my mother at the table, and with all the strength in my bony digit, I flicked the magic switch. Outside, the dusk turned instantly to dark. Inside, the light would never be the same.
I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but to me, you're like the Seamus Heaney of the spoken word Dublin scene. And it's not because of your age. It's because of the way you write your poetry. Mm-hmm. And you've managed to bring that kind of old style that we kind of studied in school. You've brought that into kind of a new era of poetry, and I love the way you do it with your like your themes and the way you write your poetry. It just, it reminds me of Yeats and Seamus Heaney, but with like a modern twist to it. So I hope you don't take that as an offensive comment.
Certainly not. No, it's, that's quite a school to be compared with. No, I mean, it is what it is, and it's what I write. I mean, it was my chosen medium. You asked me earlier, actually, I don't think I really answered you whether I was regarding myself as a poet or a spoken word artist. Well, I would say poet first, I suppose, but because I straddle the two, you know, people often refer, poets, or people who call themselves poets, at least, often with a kind of an accusatory kind of tone, say, of course, you're a spoken word person. And then some of the spoken word people think I'm a poet, so, you know, I don't know, I'm somewhere in the middle.
What do you think of the argument that if it's on the page, it's page poetry, and if it's performed, it's spoken word poetry, that there is no, like, leniency on the binary?
No, I don't subscribe to that at all. I think, as I mentioned earlier, if it's spoken, whether it's been read from the page or not, if it's spoken out loud, to me, that's spoken word. There are no definitions, and there are no rules anyway, so, I don't see... An awful lot depends on the presentation anyway. And some poets who have read their works, you hear some old recordings were actually woeful because, you know...
They couldn't read their own work.
Yeah, you know, and it didn't come... Whereas for me, what I really loved about getting into doing it without the page was you could put more feeling into it, and you had a better engagement with the audience as well, I think. I mean, as I said on stage, I think it brings... What did I say? Brings life to poetry and brings poetry to life.
Yeah, absolutely. I love
by
that.
By doing it that way, you know. I read some sort of like new stuff. I tend to read for a while anyway, even in performance, like, you know.
Do you have any influences on your work right now?
Right now, probably not. And I try to avoid having, but, you know, subconsciously, of course, there are. And things, I keep discovering things in my own words that I didn't realise at the time of writing that they came from somewhere else. Like, there's one, for example, I wrote a poem about Guernica, you know, the town in Spain that was bombed by the fascists during the Spanish Civil War. And there's a line towards the end of it. Quiet and the noise, like silent. No, what was it? I can't remember it offhand now. It'll come back to me. But that was a line that I realised years later came from my experience of being close to one of the car bombs in Dublin in 1974. And I'd visited Guernica maybe, I don't know, in the 80s sometime, and wrote this poem sometime later afterwards. And this line came into it. And it's only when I was thinking about it, I said, how would I know that? You know, I wasn't there in Guernica. I was very close to the bomb in Dublin, which, and so that's where that line came from. I realise that now, but at the time I was writing it, I had no idea where it was coming from, you know. And that's the thing about writing poetry or whatever, that it should come, I suppose, from
the outside experiences and things like that. Because that's one of the questions I hate, but it's one I feel like should always be asked, because people like to know who you're listening to and influences your work, but... it's not just people that influence your work. It's like where you are in the moment, the social issues that are on at the moment, how people are reacting to like the world you're currently living in. I feel like that's your influence, really.
Yeah. Somebody defined poetry or whatever as an emotional feeling that comes, but is written in tranquility or something like that, you know, that you go through the experience and then it later comes back out in as a poem or as words. But I've been reading an awful lot, obviously, and I have a stack of books that I haven't read yet as well, picked up along the way. But I've been going to so many performances and festivals and poetry sessions of one kind or another, so it's just a whole mishmash. And I've never been, you know, back in the early days, I suppose I was influenced by indirectly by the beat poets, the American beat poets, but also there was a kind of a scene in the UK at the time, and the Liverpool poets were I suppose the next best thing.
I've never heard of the Liverpool poets.
Well, you know, Roger McGough was one of them at the time, and Mike, what was his name, Adrian Henry, and they were both involved in music as well at the time. And when it was a poetry group I was involved with here in Dublin back in the late 60s, early 70s, and used to bring some of these over to perform as sort of guest performers and so on, and influenced by that, and by the whole nature of that and by the quirkiness of their words. Leonard Cohen would have been another one that fell into that category as well. I was into his poetry kind of before I had heard him sing even, you know, so, and but along the way, everybody and anybody, and it's, I like certain poems, not necessarily all the poems by anybody, including my own. But I suppose it's a bit like wine, you know, if you taste it, you like it, you drink it, you know, and the poems are the same. If something catches you, it might only be a line or it might only be a turn of phrase in a poem, whether you read it or hear it. And one of the great things, I mean, and I've heard several people say this about going to nights, you know, like any of the regular nights that are on or used to be on, and you just leave full of, you know, somebody else, somebody put it like, what was it, a group of punch drunk poets with too many emotions and not enough coping mechanisms.
I love that. But, I love that so much. But I really want to ask you about how Lingo got set up. I know it was yourself and four other poets from Dublin that came together and set up the first ever spoken word festival.
That's right. Yeah. It seems like history now, dim memories. But it's only 3 years, only actually 2.5 years ago or so that it really finished finally. But how that came about, there was this whole burgeoning scene, as I say, where there were events, regular events on, and there was a notion that we should make something more of it. Now, there was another little side story as well, where there was a competition or a call out from Guinness at the time to fund the arts, and people were asked to submit proposals and have them voted on then on social media or whatever. And a bit of a row broke out about that, about selling your soul to big
corporations. Yeah.
So out of that emerged, well, okay, we'll scrap that idea. So let's just get together and have a chat and see. So there was a meeting called, I can't remember who exactly called
it. So it was yourself, Stephen James Smith,
Cal Ryan, Colm Keegan, Aaron Farnoff, and then Linda Devlin came in as the supremo, who put us all, shaped us all up into and kept us on a straight and narrow to actually run a festival, as opposed to just because around talking about it, you know.
And do you remember what was on the programme for the first year? Like what guests you had, any workshops, any events?
Yeah, who did we have the first year? We had Polar Bear was one of the headliners anyway. We had Paula Meehan, actually, speaking of Page and whatever else, and she really was enthusiastic about the whole thing, you know. In fact, I heard her saying something recently that really resonated with me. She said, poetry is to humans as birdsong is to birds. I thought that was really, that really summed it up for me. But anyway, so we got together and it was, what do we do with this? And then the idea emerged to, let's try and run a spoken word festival. There isn't one, so let's put one together. So that's how it came about. And it was then volunteers were sought, I suppose, who wanted to actually get involved in doing this. So there were a few other people involved at the very outset, and some dropped off for one reason or another, and it ended up then down to six. And that, our first one was in 2014, and It was a nervy time because we had very little funding and we were relying on people coming through the doors, which
they
did. Who
gave you your first bout of funding?
DCC, Dublin City Council, were the first ones to come on board. And the other thing that happened that year was we organised, people who were running regular events like Aidan Murphy at the Monday Echo, Callum with the Brown Bread mixtape, and Nighthawks, Callum was involved with, and a few others dedicated some of their nights, especially to raising fund, having a whip around, basically, because none of these places had cover charges, and donating it to the Lingo as well. So, and then on the first evening, I remember it so well, we were all inside in the Workman's Club waiting for the opening event, and we're all scurrying around, putting the last minute bits together, and somebody said there's a queue outside. So the door was open and the whole room filled up, and we said, yes, it's happening. So that was a moment, you know.
And it lasted 3 years?
Lasted 3 years, yeah. And, you know, and then we ran a once-off event with Shane Kaizen in May 2017, I think. But yeah, 2014, 15 and 16 were the three festivals. But it was amazing and it grew. Like, we got great publicity, and, you know, Marina on Radio 1 dedicated an hour-long programme each year before, a week or so beforehand to promote it. We got a lot of mainstream media on the works as well, and several local stations. So we got a huge goodwill for it. And it was successful by any definition. I mean, another moment was on the night Saul Williams was headlining, and it was in the Button Factory, and it was a wet Sunday night in October, and there were 550 people or so queuing around the block to come in to listen to that, and it was just amazing as well, you know. So, yeah, so it was by any measure a success, and, you know, it achieved, it ticked all the boxes. We wanted to raise the profile of what was going on. We wanted to bring it to a wider audience. We also wanted to give people who were performing week in, week out at events for nothing to come and perform to a wider audience and to be paid for doing so, however small it might be, but at least it was more than we're getting for every other event at the time.
Were there plans to expand it outside of Dublin or just to keep it Dublin-centric?
No, well, there were talks about that, and there were also, what we did was we tried to ensure all sorts of, you know, inclusiveness of having, you know, we had a thing called North, South, East, West, an event at one of the festivals, which had people from each province. And pretty much, we had open calls for submission as well. So, like, we had a lot of people applying to be involved from, not just from all over Ireland, but from UK and the US and further afield even, you know. So it was quite amazing. And there were a lot of strands to it. We had, you know, we commissioned new work, or not commissioned it, but invited people to submit new work, which was selected then for, and got a special tranche of funding. We began to get bits of funding from other sources, including eventually the Arts Council, which
eventually,
I know you have views on. You know, we had to, it's like we were saying earlier, you have to kind of build up a credibility, I suppose, before some people will come on board. We got funding from Fáilte Ireland. We got funding from Poetry Ireland, which I think began to bring them into the, I think it had a huge effect, because people began to take note of it and began to say, well, we better begin to take this seriously.
It looked
seriously.
Like it was becoming, as you say, a lot more serious and successful. What
the other thing that happened, actually, just to go back on bringing it around the country as opposed to Dublin, we began to get invited, actually, to bring it to other festivals, like the Kirch Festival, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
We ran a couple of events down there. Let Your Picnic, we had a stage.
So kind of, you know, broadening out to Galway and
and loads of people were inviting us to do this, but we just didn't have the resource or the capacity to do it. I mean, it was all, this was all run voluntarily by ourselves, and mostly work done in the middle of the night when everything else had kind of stopped, you know, because people just were busy otherwise, you know. So
is Electric Picnic in Wicklow?
No, in Kildare. wait, no, is it? No, it's in Laois.
I was thinking of Knockinstocking for some reason.
Oh, Knockinstocking, yeah.
That's fantastic.
We brought it. The first year or so we did, you know, Dublin Book Festival, we got involved in that. There was a lot of, we had a lot of requests that we weren't able to fulfil because we just didn't have the capacity to do it. And that is, it kind of came to a close because we had reached capacity level, and we had already diversified it a lot. And, you know, talk more about that if you want, but it's all out there in the programs if they're around. But eventually we would have needed to, we came to the conclusion we would have needed, first of all, an awful lot more funding to take it really onwards. Mm. And we would also need to have put somebody working on it, probably nearly full time, or certainly at least as a part time. And that, of course, creates a whole lot of other responsibilities and employee relations and getting into all that. I mean, we were tax-wise involved, all right, but other rules and regulations, you know, it was just a bridge too far for those of us who were involved. And so we threw down the challenge to others, I suppose, to take it up from there, run with it.
Yeah. So let's hear about your second poem. Would you like to introduce it?
The second poem, yeah, it's a thing I wrote. It's a more recent one, and it's a funny little backdrop to it. I was in Washington, D.C., fortunately, because of the poetry, just about a week after Donald Trump was inaugurated as president, and everybody there was very upset and distraught about this and worried about the future. And the one line that was said several times I heard while I was there was, well, however bad things look, maybe at least some great new creativity or art will come out of it. So, yeah, I held on to that line as well, and it's in this, but not maybe as positively as they were holding on to it. So that was kind of, if you like, the one line thing that kind of inspired us, but it's just a look at the world we're living in at the moment from my perspective. Beyond the calm. These are wasted days, scary times we share as best we can, days when everyone wants to talk, but no one cares to listen, and so the tyrants are unleashed. These are brittle days, so little chimes with what we know, time ticks towards an alien place that may hold no trace of anything we know or love. Before sleep, I ponder questions that in future may be asked, like how so few could bring disaster to so many. In sleep, I wander through a landscape of upturned trees, their budding leaves beneath the soil, buried to protect the life inside, roots reaching to whatever heaven there may be, tentacles outstretched in desperate dying pleas, beseeching the tyrants to relent. I wake to find the nightmare real in a fruitless day. Headshakers declare that truthlessness surrounds. Great art may come of it, some say, but can we find beauty in all this death?
Did you know that my first time ever performing spoken word was in Lingo?
I knew you were involved. Was it as one of the youth groups or that? I remember it actually, and it was in upstairs in
Ballymun, the Axis.
Where you did the work with Colm, was it?
Yeah, so it was with Colm and Elaine.
And then you performed in upstairs in the Stag's Head, was it, or something?
No, it was actually the boys' school in Smock Alley.
Oh, was that one? Yeah, there was different years.
It was like a group of us, and essentially Colm and Elaine were trying to get us to perform our work and not crumble to the ground in front of people. That was my first time.
Amazing.
And I was like, oh my God.
Lingo did nothing else. It did something other than.
But it was like there's a spoken word festival. There's like all these amazing artists and like young people are there and like, you know, older people are there. Like there's so much to, you know, sink your teeth into. And then it kind of just went downhill from there.
Not at all, no, not from what I've seen and heard anyway. So, and of course, what you're doing now with the Boundless and Bare as well is kind of, it's by another name almost, you know, bringing it to people in a different format.
Trying to bring it together because I felt like Lingo,
you've been curating or promoting, because I actually had the chance to perform at Mudwards this year for the first time as well. And the session I was at, some of your proteges or whatever, I don't know what to call them, people you curated at least are sent on tour around Ireland performing there. Yeah.
It's what we do is essentially just trying to connect all the spoken word communities around Ireland and bring poets that wouldn't have ordinarily got the chance to go to other places and show their work and that kind of thing.
Well, that's very, very much like the objectives that Lingo had.
I learned from the best, you know what? So I would love to know if you have a favourite or like the worst gig ever that's like seared into your memory.
And my own personal that I did. Oh my God. There's so many, I suppose, that are kind of favourite memories. I have a worst one. I know, I remember leaving out a couple of lines out of a poem one night, and was on the bus on the way home and it dawned on me, but nobody else knew apart from me, so I figured it didn't make any difference. I don't I don't think I can think of a bad experience, really.
Do you have a favourite one?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I went down to Electric Picnic, even though it didn't turn out to be all that I had it cracked up to be in my mind, was a great, just the thought of doing it and being involved, because my daughters had been going to it, and here I was going to allegedly perform, you know, so that was a great moment. But I've had a few, and certainly, you know, being involved in some festivals. St. Patrick's Festival, I was on the Poetry Trail there a couple of years ago. I did one in Paris, actually, to just drop that in there as a name, a couple of years ago with, it was hosted by the Irish Embassy there, and I did it with a guy called Barry Douglas, who's a very renowned and decorated concert pianist, I suppose you say. He's from Northern Ireland originally, but he is one of the tops in the world, I think, is what he does.
So you performed your poetry with him playing in the background?
We didn't do it together, but we interspersed.
So
I'd do a couple of poems, he'd do a couple of piano pieces, classical, and it worked really well, and it was a full room. And it was probably, I suppose, when you think of highs and lows, you think of how nervous you are before something, and that was one where I was really in a ball of sweat beforehand, because I was awed by the fact that this guy was so renowned and decorated as well, and then I was performing there. It was a very prestigious kind of setup as well, with a full room of people whom I didn't know, you know, and so, yeah. But there are many like that, you know. I mean, you're only as good as your last performance, I suppose, as the saying goes. So probably everyone you do, as long as it doesn't go pear-shaped, is a good moment. You know?
And what are your plans for the future? Have you got gigs lined up? You're talking a little bit about maybe a future collection of sorts?
That's, yeah. I mean, what I try to do every year is do something different, you know, to branch out and to do something that I didn't do before. Like this year, was a few festivals that I hadn't been involved in before. Also, a few guest slots that I got asked to do, like the All-Ireland Slam Night, for example. I was involved in a collaborative project this year, which was very interesting. I'd never done anything like that before, where we came together with, in my case, with a multimedia artist, and we put together a poem, film kind of thing.
And can you find that on YouTube?
It should be up there someplace, yeah.
What's it called?
It's called In Betweenness is the piece we did, is the name we gave it.
It'll be in the show notes, folks.
It was part of an exhibition that was out in Dunleary then for about 10 days as a result of this. So what the idea behind this was, there were about 50 people got involved in the project. It was open to whoever. It's an art network group that's based out there. And the idea was that two people at least, or maybe sometimes three, but two or more would come together from different genres. Like, so it could be a sculptor and a musician, or a poet and a painter, or whatever the hell, you know. So that was interesting. So I always try to do something new every year. I don't set out what it is, except that I do something different that I haven't done before. So I don't know what next year will bring. But collection-wise, yes, I am trying to, that flow that I was talking about earlier that I expected to come after the first collection is a trickle still, and is coming together into a flood, hopefully, possibly next for public. I'm hoping, yeah, for next year sometime, yeah.
I can't wait, because I love your stuff. Honestly, I love your stuff. It's short and sweet. It's not, you know what I mean? Like, you know when you're going to go off, you're not going to have like long, drawn out pieces. It's like snappy and good, and like you hit the spot. So I can't wait for your second collection.
Thank you for saying so.
Okay, so I think we're going to go on to our three questions, or two questions on a demand. So, Phil, if you could be a pizza topping, what topping would you be and why?
Lots of options there. The one I think of, which always surprises me anyway in a pizza, is, you know, that hot chili sauce that you get, comes in a bottle and you hold it gingerly over
Tabasco
the pizza
kind of stuff,
and you try to not let it flow too much because it'll destroy the thing, but then it drips out, and some places it drips more than others, and you're eating through it, and kind of reminds me, it's a bit like life itself, or the poetry, for example. You know, you come across a good piece here, you know, and you're eating through it, it's soaked into it, so you don't know where the drops are that are going to or sort of half burn the mouth off you. So all these little, like little bombs going off in the pizza as you're eating it. And yeah.
That's the most poetic answer we've had for that question.
Right. Not about that, but anyway. Yes.
I think today I'm feeling like, have you ever seen one of those cake pizzas that it's shaped like a pizza, but it's like a cake all the way through, and it's like chocolate and ganache and stuff like that all on top of it?
Sounds gruesome, but anyway,
yeah, I'm definitely that kind of pizza today. And it's weird, like the thing, because I'm celiac, and it's the things that you're not allowed to have are the things that you crave the most.
Yeah,
and I think if I was a pizza topping, I would be custard.
I love custard, actually.
And I'm just obsessed with custard right now. I don't know if it's just Christmas time and like there's so many beautiful like...
And is custard celiac friendly?
No.
No, that's what, not, that's what it has. Yeah. Full of, yeah.
Yeah, so today I am custard. Day.
Okay, well, sure, you have to have moments to break out, you know.
I know, right? So our next question is, if you could have a superpower, what power would you have and why?
Oh, yeah. Well... So many things you could think of on that. I suppose if you were to have a superpower, it'd be nice to be able to put it to use of people, of other people who didn't have, or to society or something. So I think in terms of, you know, being able to solve the health and housing problems or something like that, or, you know, stop conflicts all over the world. But there is one at a more personal level that I would actually love to be able to understand how nature works. I mean, in terms of, say, animals, not so much even birds, especially. Birds fascinate me. How do they communicate? How do they migrate back and forth across continents? You know, things like that.
Because don't they? They have their like direction by the magnetic fields.
It's something like that. Yeah,
yeah, but that's how they never get lost.
But how do they know? I mean, where does this come from? You know, and how did they learn it in the first place? And, you know, well, if you could understand how they communicate with each other, and I'm sure they do. I believe they do, anyway.
So and, a more advanced Dr. Dolittle type power.
Yeah, and to be able to actually communicate with them as well, you know. Like, there's a story about some particular butterflies I heard, and I've never, I keep meaning to look it up, in South, they migrate from South America to Canada, I think. And apparently
these
they,
are butterflies?
Yeah, apparently they stop off, they die along the way, and they procreate and die. And their offspring or whatever.
Continue the journey.
I don't know what the terminology is. Yeah, continues the journey. And this happens about twice or three times on the journey, and they make it back, and then they do it in reverse again to go back to...
That is mental. Oh my
it
God.
Is mental, and maybe it's not even true, but it sounds good anyway.
Yeah, it sounds
but
good.
I did hear this, and I keep meaning to check out the actual factual details of it, but it has just come into my mind there when we're talking about the birds. And so, yeah, so maybe that could be edited out as not being, as being fake news, but... No, I think I definitely heard it, whether the person who told it was telling the truth or not. It was on some nature program or something, yeah.
Oh, I love watching those.
But yeah, no, I you know, I notice lately, because I go down to the park near me every day, more or less, weather permitting, and the birds, like the particularly the big birds, like the blackbirds and the rooks and so on, and hooded crows, are all much more adventurous in coming, not running away or flying away, I should say. Like they used to years ago, you wouldn't come within a mile of a human, you know. And now I see them, they're kind of looking at you with one eye, you know, the way they do. It's much to say, you know, your time is nearly over. we're here, we're going to be here, but you lot will be gone. And we're not afraid of you anymore, and you're destroying the place, you know.
Damn. So well, it looks like you're already kind of communicating if you can get that much out of them. So,
well.
So I think my superpower today, it's gotten so cold. I would love to be able to regulate my body temperature to the point where I can become like a supernova that like I'm not going to hurt myself by doing so. Just a gigantic radiator. And then if I need to, I can like cool my body down. So if somebody needs like something cold, I'll be like an ice like person and I can like hug them. And, you know, selfish superpower.
Emotional heating.
I can help people if they need heat or like to cool down.
Yeah, that would be amazing, all right, yeah.
I mean, it's not as good as talking to birds and like sussing out nature, but you know what? This is my superpower, and I'm gonna be it.
That would have implications for all the sort of clothes you buy, places you live.
Maybe I don't need clothes. Yeah. Maybe I finally become a nudist. Like, you know, try stop me. Yeah. I'll burn you or I'll freeze you. Okay, we are on to our last. It's a demand. Let's just face it. It's a demand. Do you have a joke, a wholesome moment, or a funny story?
I wasn't looking for this moment to arrive, as the song goes. My joke telling is not my forte, but it was a thing I remember. It used to annoy people when they'd be doing sort of jokes or riddles or something like that. More a riddle, I suppose, and say, you know, what is it? My problem with jokes actually is I often have the punchline away first or else forget it. But anyway, this one was, what's green and has wheels?
A green truck.
No, grass. I was only joking about the wheels. I told you not to ask me that. Anyway,
that's so stupid. Yeah. I love it. So we are slowly wrapping up the end of this episode. So
funny story, actually, we're talking about birds every time for this.
Yeah,
little
go
anecdote.
For it.
I remember living in Belgium in Brussels, and was at an early morning French class. Actually, I came out of this building, and there was this big thoroughfare, about five lanes of a one-way street. And next thing I noticed, things were at a standstill even more than usual. People were out of their cars, business people in suits and everything else were kind of going around. But and next thing I realized, saw there was a pigeon who had eaten into a slice of bread, which had slipped down over his neck and clipped his wings. And he's strutting around the street with this bread hanging, clinging to him, and he couldn't get out of it. And there were guys crawling around literally on the streets, and he was running in under cars and everything. Somebody finally got him, and took him to the sidewalk, released him. Anyway, you can edit that out as well.
Oh, thank you for that. That's just given me a wholesome kind of thought for this morning. Okay, so we are wrapping up the end of the episode. Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, pleasure. Thank you very much for asking.
All the details will be in the show notes at the end. Tune in to our next episode. And Phil, do you want to tell us about your third and final poem?
Oh, yeah. This poem is something that I've described as my signature tune, kind of, because people have actually requested it on occasion, which is not a boast, it's actually true, not fake news. And it's funny because it's one of those rare things that comes in a moment almost. And I was on the way home from something one night on top of the bus, 46A, if I remember rightly. And I was trying to write something else. So I also have a notebook and pen with me. And this thing kept coming, and I was flicking over to another page and writing and trying to get back to the other thing, and it wouldn't let. So, and I scarcely edited a changed word hardly in it at all. It was just a little kind of love thing to my wife, I suppose. And I remember going into, I think it was the Monday Echo, a couple of nights later, and I'll just read it out as it was. And I've got a reaction. People, the only one that people commented on that night that I did. So, right, there must be something in it. So I've held on to it, and I tend to wind up most of the nights or most of the slots I do with it, even though I tried not to, but it comes back at me.
Okay, and what's it called?
It's actually called My Wife Thinks I'm at a Poetry Reading, which is possibly why it has that effect, because that always gets a bit of a titter around the place, and then I went to it. So I don't know if it's just the title or the actual content that people like, but anyway.
Okay, enjoy this final poem by Phil Lynch. I have been Melissa, and thank you, Phil, for coming on with us.
Thank you very much indeed. It was, as I said, an honour and my pleasure. My wife thinks I'm at a poetry reading. The truth is, I am. But I keep all my best words, all the here in my chest words, all my bare and undressed words, all the never mind the weather words, all the keeping us together words, all the under my breath words, the no need to be said words, the all in my head words. I keep them all, like the best wine, except not for the last time, but like every time is the first time. And so, for my next poem. Ah, now, that one's for later when I get home.